This week in the studio, one band, one year, three hit albums.
The song Green River is drawn from my childhood.
Down on the corner, out in the street, playing the pork boy, the playing, bring the nip of happy feet.
Green River, like all the songs that I wrote for Creedence, are drawn on my own childhood or life experiences. In other words, what you've been hearing all these years really is my life.
In 1969, Creedence Clearwater Revival pulled off a musical trifecta. Led by singer-songwriter lead guitarist John Fogerty, Creedence Clearwater Revival released three million-seller hit albums entitled Bayou Country, their second, Green River, and then Willie and the Poor Boys, all in the calendar year 1969. Now that's a feat that has never been equaled, and I doubt seriously if it ever will. The first of the three, Bayou Country, was released in January that year and is, quote, a superb statement of purpose that captures Creedence Clearwater Revival's muscular, spare, deceptively simple sound as an evocative portrait of America, writes Stephen Thomas Erlewine in the All Music Guide. It turns out that as an adolescent, CCR creative genius John Fogerty had made a solemn promise to himself to master the electric guitar like his heroes.
Well, I took a look at people like Chet Atkins, Duane Eddy, James Burton, who was playing then with... Actually, the first thing he did, I loved, but I didn't know it was him. It was on a record called Susie Q by Dale Hawkins.
Uh-huh.
I only found out years later that was James. Oh, my goodness. I mean, he was like 15 years old at the time.
Really?
And bending strings all over the place even then. I guess a little bit later, people like Roy Nichols, who played with Merle Haggard, Don Rich with Buck Owens. You know, these were guys who were really great on the guitar, really great guitar players. And when I was about 14, I had made it up. I had decided in my mind that I wanted to grow up and be like that. In other words, when I was younger, I was just sort of walking around the house singing and going doo-wop and... In fact, I named my first imaginary group Johnny Corvette and the Corvettes.
Ooh, I like that.
Guess who Johnny was? You know? Well, this was 1953. I was about 8 years old, and that was the first year of the Corvette,
which was
and is an awesome American sports car. in fact, I have one of those now.
What year?
Mine's an 87. I finally got one. I waited all those years. But anyway... By the time I was 14, I realized I wanted to be a guitar player and a good one. And the guys I have mentioned, especially Chet and James Burton, were like masters of the field they were in. You know, Chet wasn't much rock and roll, but he was eloquent, just, you know, great stuff. And James was just smoking rock and roll stuff. And a little bit later, the country and all that string bending. I wanted to be like that. That's what I promised myself that I would become.
Bye. title song from the August 1969 Green River album, reached number two in America and was another million seller for Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Your prolific Creedence body of work had a heavy, rural, and distinctly Southern flavor. Vivid images of swamps and bayous and hoodoo. Where were you and your brothers, Tom and Bob, raised?
We grew up in the Bay Area of California. In other words, across the bay from San Francisco. We used to play in the El Cerrito swamps all the time. Yeah, there are no swamps there, or delta. Or actually, there's a Sacramento delta, but it's not that delta.
So in summer vacations, did you ever do the cabin in the woods and the whole thing with the family?
Well, actually, yeah, the song Green River is drawn from my childhood. That's we used to go up to this cabin, as you said, on the Puta Creek outside of Winters, California. It's up in Northern California. And the cabin, the story I got, remember, I was like 4 or 5 years old, this old guy who was like 75, we called him Cody, or sometimes they call him Old Grandpa Cody, and he was reputed to be a direct descendant of Buffalo Bill. Hence, in the song Green River, I called him Old Cody Jr. And Green River, like all the songs that I wrote for Creedence, are drawn on my own childhood or life experiences. In other words, what you've been hearing all these years really is my life.
Not unlike the late George Harrison of the Beatles, John Fogerty feels that sudden pop stardom with Creedence Clearwater Revival so early in John's career had a stunting effect on Fogerty's growth as a guitarist.
Unfortunately, then somewhere around the age of 18 or 19, at when my songwriting really started to get better, I became famous with Creedence Clearwater, and my guitar chops kind of just froze right where they were. I really, I was rock and roll good, but I wasn't really, really good like I had promised myself. It's kind of like the old joke. I was 30 years old before I found out I had no talent, but it was too late. I was already famous. So, yeah, I was kind of frozen in, you know, what I was doing with Creedence, which was nice, hummable stuff. You know, my guitar playing, you could always hum the leads. It was never any knock 'em dead kind of stuff like James Burton. It was just, you know, it's good. I mean, there's times when you ought to just shut up and play nicely. But I wanted to be that other guy, too. And it's only been the last few years that I've started to just get into the footsteps, let's say, of a James Burton. Of course, I'm getting where he was 30 years ago, so I have a long way to go.
August 1969's Green River album, Bad Mood Rising, hit number one in the UK, number two in the States.
John, with all seriousness, with the possible exception of Robbie Robertson, who's Canadian, no one in contemporary music has written so often, so well, about rural Southern culture. So how did your outsider's perspective, like Robertson's, help you see the cross-cultural uniqueness of the South?
To say it simply, it's not something I think about. Other than, you know, it's been pointed out to me a lot that I'm Southern a lot, and of course I didn't grow up in the South. And all I can say is that rock and roll itself was very, very Southern in its beginnings. And, you know, I've gone most years to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony and induction and all that. And the very first year was a class of 10, and of course, including Elvis and Fats Domino and Jerry Lee and some others. Well, 10 people, actually. Some were alive, you know, and some were on poster. And I stood there, and as I counted, I knew that 9 of them were from the South. The only guy I wasn't sure about was Sam Cooke, and I learned later that he was indeed from the South. And I rest my case. I mean, I stood there in 1986 looking at that class, the first class, the first really major people from rock and roll, and that was what was in my mind. I said, you know, this is a pretty Southern thing here, and I can testify about everybody there except one, and I later confirmed Sam Cooke, too. So all 10, you know, rock and roll is just a Southern thing. I started paying attention to that in the very beginning.
about a year ago. I set out on the road, seeking my fame and fortune, looking for a pot of gold. Things got bad and things got worse. I guess you know the tune. Oh Lord, stuck in a low die again. Rode in on a greyhound. I'll be walking out if I go. I was just passing through. Must be 7 months or more. Ran out of time and money. Looks like they took my friend. Oh Lord, I'm stuck in a
Clearwater Revival with Lodi from their first number one selling album, Green River, which is number 96 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 albums of all time. Because of his affinity for the country and western and blues roots of rock and roll, John Fogerty gravitated toward all manner of things distinctly southern, from literature to movies.
And I think later that spilled over into the other things in my life, especially entertainment things. Meaning that since music was so important to me and this stuff was the most important, I would hang on to movies like, let's say, Tennessee Williams stuff. Remember that old movie, The Defiant Ones, Tony Curtis and Sidney? I don't know where it occurred, but I'm sure it was the South if they had a chain gang and all that, you know.
To Kill a Mockingbird?
I was just real intrigued with those kind of things, but I didn't sit around and really exclude it from other parts of life or notice it in a more... I didn't know I was noticing it specially. I just thought that was normal. That's what I, you know, paid attention to. It's only now, many years after Proud Mary, let's say, that people sort of point out that it's a little odd that you'd never been to the Mississippi River, but you wrote about it.
That's fascinating. You actually made an observation also about that part of the world that gave us this to our culture, about it geographically. The fact that this area, geographically, is not that big a place, is it?
Oh, no, especially if you go down to the Mississippi Delta. That, to me, it's... Because I read The Day Christ Died, I think, by James Bishop, probably when I was in the 10th grade or something. Which, of course, is about the Holy Land, too. And on the first page, he points out that the Holy Land is a very small place. I think you could walk it in a few days. And that's the way I I noticed a similarity about the Delta, that it was really a tiny area of the world to be so important in our American culture and therefore all over the world.
Delightful Down on the Corner from November 1969's Willie and the Poor Boys was Creedence Clearwater Revival's fourth million-selling single, topping out at number 3 in the U.S. on the chart. Amazingly, 20 long years would pass before John Fogerty would admit to himself that CCR's incredible success at that tender age had sidetracked his firsthand knowledge of the region about which he'd written so often.
Well, I'm not sure you always know what's missing. You just know that something's missing. I had the vague feeling that, that you talked about the 14-year-old boy promising himself to grow up and be a great musician, a guitar player specifically. I began to have more and more the sense that I was not. And, unless I'm going to be reincarnated or in some other parapsychological way, get to come back here and, get to come back as James Burton, it was time for me to get my act in gear, I guess. But I didn't know it all that clearly. I'm saying this now. I at the time, this is about 1989, 88 even, I started having this longing or an urge to go to Mississippi, but I didn't have a clue why. And, it's the weirdest feeling when something is pushing you to go someplace. And, we all have our own lives and busy lives, and we have commitments and that sort of thing. And it just seemed like too much trouble. Why do you want to go do that? So I kept putting off the feeling because it didn't make any sense to me. And later I've used the kind of the picture of the guy in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where he's making the mashed potatoes on the table and it getting this high and he's going boo doo doo boo doo, and he doesn't have a clue. And of course everybody in the neighborhood thinks he is stone out of his mind. That's how I felt. And finally the urge was too strong. Now remember, I've never been in Mississippi, even though I've written, some of these Southern songs, as you say. I didn't even know where to go. I just felt like I had to go find the Delta, because I'd heard about that all my life. But I, you know, think about it. If you've never been there, what, do you put a backpack on your, you know, on your back and get on a bicycle and go somewhere?
Timeless quality and sheer power conveyed in the song Fortunate Son comes from Creedence Clearwater Revival's November 1969 Willie and the Poor Boys album, which Rolling Stone magazine ranks at number 388 on their top 500 albums of all time. Still to come, the Swami of Swamp Rock takes his first pilgrimage to the Mississippi Delta 20 years after Proud Mary. For this and your other favorite musician interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for the anniversaries of Creedence Clearwater Revival's Green River and Willie and the Poor Boys. I'm Redbeard. So as improbable as it sounds, Creedence songwriter, singer, guitarist John Fogerty was not born on the bayou or anywhere even close. And he stayed away from the American South until a full 20 years after these three albums defined his sound.
So I actually went to New Orleans the first time and went across the bridge of, across the Mississippi and came up from the southern Mississippi, which is really the wrong way to approach this for any of you that are contemplating such a trip. Anyhow,
water flows down, doesn't
it's
it?
More yes. Better, yeah, to go, come from Memphis. This is, after a few trips, I finally figured out this is why Memphis plays such a big part in the Mississippi blues syndrome and in American rock and roll and blues, too. It's because that's really the first big city that you hit coming north from out of Mississippi. It's where everybody would stop, and some, of course, stayed there. So I took the first trip, kind of meandered and didn't know where I was, why I was there, and ended up in Hattiesburg. And that was really not really the Delta. And it was, you know, 4 or 5 days had passed. I finally, you know, my wife was waiting for me at home, so I came home. But I vowed to go back and kind of get it right the next time. I ended up doing 5 or 6 trips, something like that. And I got pretty good at it after a while. I had this whole, you know, a couple of knapsacks or suitcases.
Carpet bag.
Well, whatever. No, please. I wasn't selling no insurance.
Okay.
And I, you know, notebooks and tape recorders and finally records and cassettes that I could play in the rent-a-car and eventually a camera. I took hundreds of pictures, and I'm not in a one of them. You know, I've got a lot of pictures of snakes and turtles crossing the road and water towers with every little town's name on them. You know, I mean, it's great stuff to me. I've made several albums. Muddy Waters' house when it was still there.
We'll take the gold from the mine.
Shrewdly, Fantasy Records owner Saul Zantz not only owned the recordings, he'd also negotiated to own the publishing rights to John Fogerty's incredible treasure chest of songs that would later become a bitter bone of contention after CCR disbanded in 1972 and John embarked on a solo career, as Fogerty felt that his songwriting legacy was being held hostage. The issue eventually ended up in the courts and became so personal that at one point, Zantz sued Fogerty for plagiarizing himself. The case was dismissed. Meanwhile, for almost a generation, John Fogerty would not perform his beloved Creedence songs live. To do so would have literally lined the pockets of his sworn enemy. This inability to claim or exploit his own catalog and songwriting legacy affected John Fogerty's career clear up till 1997.
Well, I think there was a lot of confusion when I wouldn't play the old songs I had written, the songs that a lot of people just call Creedence songs. Actually, you know that they were all written by John Fogerty, and sung by John, too. That's John, that's me. I'm looking at in the mirror now. So this is kind of a way of assuring or reassuring everybody by doing it this way first, and hopefully in a smaller venue, it is more intimate. You know, I saw Eric Clapton this way, and I loved it. That's one of the best nights I've ever seen anywhere. He just played the blues, man. Yeah, it was great. And so I think to reassure the world, really, or anybody that's paying attention to me, that I'm indeed doing the older songs and, you know, kind of where my chops are at now, too.
In the morning, you hear the work bell ring, and I march you to the table. You see the same old thing, ain't no food upon the table. There's no fork up in the pan, but you better not complain, boy. You get in trouble with the man.
Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine an ever-loving light on me.
Yonder come Miss Rosie. How in the world did you know? By the way she wears an apron and the clothes she wore, umbrella on her shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. She come to see the governor. She want to free her man. Oh.
Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special.
I'm going to come out of the closet now. We've been working for over a month. Well, that's in vogue now, right? Doesn't everybody come out of the closet?
Yeah.
And I've decided that first off, we're going to play the entire Grateful Dead repertoire. And then for an encore, we'll just, you know, settle down with the Beatles catalog. And then, no, seriously, I'm going to do songs from throughout or over my entire career, which... Of course, most people know me from the Creedence days, and what it means is hopefully I will be able to now finally at this point in my life move forward playing those songs and my current songs and not have this big sort of the wall, you know, the cave that I had to keep coming out of every time I could get away from a lawyer, I'd come out and go, here I am, and then, you know, I'd go back in the cave again because all those problems. So I'm out here for good now.
Long cat.
This is Redbeard in the studio thanking John Fogerty, one of my real heroes. You can visit inthestudio.net for this and your other favorite interviews. In the Studio was written this edition by yours truly, Redbeard. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunette. Theme song by Andy Timmons. In the Studio is now produced by Barbarossa Limited and copyright 2009. All rights reserved. Be a part of the In the Studio network at inthestudio.net.